Welcome, everyone, to another deep dive. We are absolutely thrilled to have you here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a great topic today.
It really is. So I want you to picture this. You've just landed in a foreign country. You're jet lagged. You're dragging your suitcase through the terminal. And you stop at one of those brightly lit airport currency kiosks because you desperately need a coffee.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there. Staring at the screen.
Right. You look up at that screen with all those, you know, blinking red and green numbers, and you're just trying to do the mental math of what a latte is actually going to cost you.
And mostly failing at the math, usually.
Exactly. I mean, most of us, right in that moment, are just thinking about exchange rates as this mild inconvenience, like just a conversion fee.
Yeah.
But what if I told you that the blinking screen you're staring at is actually a real-time scorecard of a nation's geopolitical power?
It really is. I mean, it's a lens that completely shifts how you view global events. Because a currency appreciating isn't just like a line on a chart ticking upward.
No.
It's a very loud signal. It means the world, collectively, is suddenly more willing to hold claims denominated in that specific currency.
Wow.
Yeah. Investors are actively buying into that nation's monetary discipline, its political stability, and, you know, its overall economic vitality.
And that is exactly our mission for today's deep dive. We are grounding this conversation in this massive, incredibly comprehensive 2026 report by the American newspaper. It's titled Exchange Rates as the Price of Power.
It's a really fantastic piece of research.
It is. So we are going to extract the core insights from this research and decode how currencies actually work. Because they are not just money. They are the prices of trust, of interest rates, and of global capital movement.
Exactly.
So, okay, let's unpack this. To really grasp how currencies wield power, we have to start by stripping away the illusion of that blinking number we see on the screen.
Right, because that number is what economists call the nominal exchange rate. It's simply the quoted price at a specific second in time.
Like just a snapshot.
Exactly, a snapshot. So if the euro to U.S. dollar rate is 1.10, you know, 1 euro buys $1.10. It's a transaction metric. But relying purely on the nominal rate is, well, it's a great way to totally misunderstand a country's actual economic strength.
Right, because it doesn't tell you what that money can actually buy in the real world.
Exactly. To find that out, you have to look at the real exchange rate. That metric adjusts the nominal price for inflation in both countries.
Oh, okay.
So consider a hypothetical country that has maintained a perfectly stable nominal exchange rate for 5 years. The line on the chart is just flat.
So you'd look at that and assume, hey, their economy is rock solid.
You would.
Oh, yeah.
But if that country is suffering from a domestic inflation rate of, say, 10% a year, while its trading partners are humming along at like 2%, that country is actually bleeding competitiveness.
Because things are getting more expensive.
Right. Its labor, its goods, its property, they're all becoming drastically more expensive relative to the rest of the world.
So it's kind of like buying a house. The nominal exchange rate is the listing price you see on the website. It looks fixed. It looks clean.
Yeah, the Zillow price.
Right, the Zillow price.
Mm-hmm.
But the real exchange rate is the listing price plus all those hidden property taxes, the wildly fluctuating utility costs, and those unexpected HOA fees that actually determine if you can afford to live there.
That's a good way to look at it. The HOA analogy gets the hidden cost aspect right, but I say it's actually more insidious than that.
How so?
Well, an HOA fee is predictable, right? Inflation isn't. It's this invisible compounding tax that's just constantly eating away at your purchasing power.
Ouch.
Yeah.
And even on the nominal side, that clean listing price you mentioned is an illusion. Converting one currency to another involves a lot of friction.
You mean like the fees at the airport?
Yeah, exactly. You have the bid price, what a dealer pays you, and the ask price, what they sell it for.
Yeah.
The spread between them is just the baseline cost.
But then you add in platform markups, slippage when the market is moving fast, wire fees, and you realize cross-border movement is incredibly taxed.
That friction is fascinating. But what really shifted my perspective in this research is how it pulls back from the transaction level and introduces this thing called the policy trilemma.
It's a trilemma.
Yes.
Because we tend to think of exchange rates as just pure math, driven by invisible hands of supply and demand. But the trilemma proves that exchange rates are ultimately deep political choices.
They really are. The open economy trilemma is basically the absolute bedrock of international macroeconomics.
Okay, lay it out for us.
It states that a country can only choose two of the following three things: a fixed exchange rate, free capital mobility, and independent monetary policy.
Just two.
Just two. The underlying mechanics make it physically impossible to have all three simultaneously.
So explain the physics of that. Why are they mutually exclusive? What happens if a country tries to, like, have its cake and eat it too?
Let's play it out. Imagine a country that wants a fixed exchange rate. Let's say they peg their currency to the U.S. dollar so their import costs are perfectly stable.
Okay, makes sense.
And they also want free capital mobility, meaning foreign investors can bring billions in and out without restrictions.
Sounds like a pretty open economy.
Right. But then a recession hits locally, and the government wants to cut interest rates independently to stimulate their own economy, while the U.S. Federal Reserve is, let's say, keeping rates high.
Oh, I see where this is going. If you cut rates, the return on investment drops.
Instantly. So investors look at the low rates in this hypothetical country, they look at the higher rates in the U.S., and they immediately pull their capital out to seek the better return.
Right, they just move their money.
Exactly. They sell the local currency to buy dollars. Now, there is massive downward pressure on the local currency, but because the government promised a fixed exchange rate, they are forced to step into the market and buy up their own currency using their foreign reserves to maintain the peg.
Which means they are essentially draining their own emergency funds just to keep the illusion alive.
Worse than that, actually. By buying their own currency, they are removing money from circulation. And shrinking the money supply naturally pushes interest rates back up. The market mechanics forcibly undo the rate cut.
Wow.
So every central bank has to pick their poison. Do you give up your peg to keep your interest rate control? Do you trap money inside your borders using capital controls? How a nation navigates that trilemma tells you everything about their political priorities.
So if the rate on the screen is hiding inflation, hidden fees, and these deep political choices, what actually makes that number move day to day? I have to admit, I always assumed a currency's strength really just came down to trade.
That's what most people think.
Right. Like, if you make great cars and electronics and the world buys them, you export more than you import, and your currency goes up. Doesn't it just come down to that?
Well, that is a very intuitive framework, and it's essentially the textbook version of economics from, say, 50 years ago.
Okay, so it's outdated.
Right. Trade balances absolutely matter for the long-term structural health of an economy. But in our highly financialized modern world, capital flows completely dominate trade flows.
By capital flows, we mean like investments, stocks, government bonds.
Yes, and corporate debt and real estate. Foreign purchases of financial assets move markets vastly faster and in much larger volumes than the physical shipment of goods across oceans.
So moving digital money is faster than moving cargo ships.
Way faster. To give you a sense of the sheer scale we are talking about, Bank for International Settlements measures over-the-counter foreign exchange turnover in their 2025 survey. The global FX market trades roughly $9.6 trillion every single day.
Wait, $9.6 trillion per day?
Per day.
It's almost hard to conceptualize. I mean, you could buy the entire economic output of most nations before your morning coffee.
It's staggering. And the vast majority of that $9.6 trillion is not companies paying for shipments of steel or soybeans. It is capital seeking a return. Money naturally flows toward higher risk-adjusted yields. This relentless search for yield creates massive, complex strategies like the carry trade.
Okay, let's unpack the carry trade for us. How does the plumbing of that actually work?
At its core, the carry trade is borrowing money where it's cheap and investing it where it pays well. Massive institutional investors will borrow billions in a currency with very low interest rates.
Like which one?
Well, historically, the Japanese yen has been the prime funding currency for this because their rates were near zero. So the investor takes that cheap borrowed yen, converts it into another currency, say the Mexican peso or the U.S. dollar, and buys government bonds offering 5, 8, or 10% yields.
So they're just pocketing the spread. I mean, it sounds like free money until something breaks.
The catch is the exchange rate risk. You eventually have to pay back the yen you borrowed. If the yen suddenly appreciates in value while you are holding those foreign bonds, your debt just became drastically more expensive. The profit margin evaporates, and if the move is violent enough, you are facing catastrophic losses.
That sounds terrifying.
It is. What's fascinating here is that this brings up a crucial point about capital flows. The market is incredibly ruthless at sniffing out true value.
Meaning investors won't just blindly chase the highest number on the board.
Exactly. Let's say an emerging economy offers a headline interest rate of 15% to attract foreign capital.
That sounds great.
On paper, yeah, it looks like a phenomenal carry trade destination. But if that same country has 12% inflation, a government prone to rewriting corporate laws overnight, and a high risk of sudden currency devaluation, your real yield, your return after accounting for inflation and political risk, is likely negative.
Wow.
High interest rates often don't signal a booming economy. They signal an economy desperate to compensate investors for massive underlying risk. Trust matters infinitely more than the headline yield.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if capital is just, sloshing around the globe to the tune of $9.6 trillion a day, seeking a balance of trust and yield, where's the center of gravity? Where is it all ultimately anchored?
Well, the data is pretty clear on that.
Right. The report makes it abundantly clear that there is an undisputed sun in our financial solar system, and it's the U.S. dollar. But it's not just because the U.S. has a massive GDP. The dollar is essentially the operating system for global finance.
That framing hits the nail on the head. The dollar is not just America's local currency. Look at the sheer mechanics of it. According to the data, the US dollar is on one side of roughly 89.2% of all daily FX trades globally.
89.2%. That's wild.
Yeah, and 2024 Fed data shows central banks hold about 58% of their official foreign reserves in dollars to protect their own economies. Global commodities, from crude oil to wheat, they're priced in dollars.
Right, everything is.
Even international supply chain invoices between two countries that have absolutely nothing to do with the U.S. are frequently settled in dollars.
Which creates this incredible phenomenon known as the safe haven crisis paradox.
Yeah.
I found this totally counterintuitive in the report. If a massive financial crisis originates inside the United States, say a banking collapse or a housing meltdown in the U.S., what happens to the value of the dollar globally?
Well, logic would suggest the dollar should plummet,
Yeah.
right? The crisis is happening on American soil.
Likely.
But historically, the exact opposite occurs. Global investors panic by dollars, and the currency surges in strength.
But if the house is on fire, why is everyone running into the burning house?
Because of the leverage built into that global operating system we just talked about. Across the globe, corporations, international banks, and sovereign governments have borrowed trillions of dollars. Their debts are dollar-linked.
Okay, so they owe dollars.
Right. And the collateral they use to secure their local banking systems heavily relies on U.S. Treasury bonds. When a crisis hits, markets freeze, and the leverage aggressively unwinds.
Meaning everyone gets called out on their bets.
Exactly. Financial institutions suddenly have to post margin, which basically means putting up emergency collateral to keep their trades open when the market moves against them. Everyone realizes simultaneously that they owe dollars, and they scramble to acquire them to pay down their debts.
That's a massive rush for the exits.
Yeah, it creates a massive global short squeeze on the US dollar.
So, for you listening to this deep dive right now, maybe you don't live in the U.S. Maybe your business doesn't export to the American market. How does this dollar hegemony actually impact you on a regular Tuesday morning?
Well, it impacts you because your local exchange rate is often less a reflection of your own country's economic health and much more a reflection of global dollar liquidity and what the U.S. Federal Reserve is expected to do with interest rates.
So the Fed is pulling the strings.
Pretty much. If the Fed raises rates, they are effectively pulling liquidity out of the global system. Dollars become scarce and expensive. Your local currency weakens against the dollar, which means importing goods costs more.
Which drives up local inflation.
Yep. That drives up local inflation, which might force your own central bank to raise interest rates, which slows down your local housing market. You are inextricably caught in the gravitational pull of the dollar.
So if the dollar is the sun, and its gravitational pull dictates the tides of global liquidity, the other currencies must be the planets in this solar system. As I was reading the source material, I couldn't help but picture the different global currencies holding completely different orbits. Each with distinct mass, atmosphere, and vulnerabilities.
That's a great analogy. The underlying architecture of these economies dictates how they behave under stress. They are absolutely not generic.
Let's map out a few of these orbits. First, we have the Korean one, the KRW. I look at the KRW as kind of a fast-moving comet or an asteroid tied to the industrial cycle. It is highly specialized, incredibly open to trade, but deeply sensitive to global semiconductor demand. What economists call a high beta currency, right?
Correct. High beta simply means it swings wildly with the broader market's momentum. If the global economy is booming and buying microchips, the won surges.
Right.
But it has a structural fragility because South Korea imports almost all its energy. So a sudden spike in global oil prices, combined with a dip in tech demand, strips away its momentum instantly. Contrast that with the Swiss franc, the CHF.
Yeah, the Swiss franc feels like this dense, heavily fortified moon.
It is the ultimate defensive tank of a currency. The Swiss franc is supported by an ironclad reputation for institutional credibility, vast wealth management reserves, and historically low inflation.
So it's a bunker.
Exactly. When the global economy enters a panic state, capital seeks refuge behind the Swiss shield. But the irony is, the franc can become too strong.
Wait, how is that a problem?
Well, a massively overvalued franc crushes Swiss exporters. It forces the Swiss National Bank to actively intervene in the markets to weaken their own money just to keep their industries competitive.
Wow, so they have to fight their own success.
Exactly.
Then you have the euro. I see the euro as this massive binary star system. It's a sprawling monetary union sharing the same atmosphere, but with fundamentally different cores.
Yes, that's the central tension of the euro.
Right, you have one central bank setting a single interest rate for Germany's heavy industrial engine and Greece's tourism-based economy at the exact same time. It's powerful, but structurally tense. And what about the Japanese yen?
The yen. If we're using the physics metaphor, the yen has historically acted like the gravitational slingshot of the financial system.
For a slingshot, I like that.
Because of Japan's massive pool of domestic savings and decades of structurally low interest rates, it is the premier funding currency, like we talked about with the carry trade.
Right.
When global markets are calm, the yen tends to drift lower as money flows out to chase higher yields elsewhere. But the moment panic strikes and all those carry trades are violently unwound, the yen snaps back and appreciates rapidly as investors buy it back to cover their debts.
So those are the massive celestial bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens to smaller economies that get caught in this orbit? If you're running a small manufacturing business in an emerging market and you buy your raw materials overseas, you are essentially standing on the edge of what economists call the emerging market crisis doom loop.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where exchange rates transition from an abstract economic metric to a localized catastrophe. The doom loop almost always starts with a structural mismatch.
What kind of mismatch?
Well, an emerging market sovereign government, or its corporate sector, decides to borrow heavily in U.S. dollars because the interest rates look significantly cheaper than borrowing in their local currency.
But the revenue they generate, like the local taxes collected, or the goods sold to domestic consumers, is entirely in their local currency.
Precisely the problem. They have engineered a massive currency mismatch on their balance sheet. They earn in pesos, or lira, or real, but their liabilities are chained to the dollar.
So if capital suddenly flies out because the U.S. raised interest rates, what mechanically breaks inside that emerging economy?
Capital flight causes the local currency to depreciate against the dollar. Instantly, the real burden of that dollar-denominated debt skyrockets.
Even without borrowing more money.
Right. The company or the country didn't borrow a single new dollar, but they now need vastly more of their own local currency to make the exact same dollar interest payment.
Oh, that's brutal.
And this terrifying realization causes domestic investors to panic. They rush to sell their local currency to get dollars to protect their own savings. This domestic capital flight accelerates the depreciation even further.
So it just feeds on itself. The currency drops, the debt gets heavier, the panic increases, the currency drops more.
It is a violent, self-reinforcing downward spiral. Corporate bankruptcies loom because companies can no longer service their foreign debt. The central bank tries to step in by spending its dollar reserves to prop up the exchange rate.
But if they run out?
If the market smells blood and sees those reserves draining, the panic turns into a total stampede.
We spent a lot of time analyzing how nations survive or collapse based on these macro dynamics. So what does this all mean for you, the listener? How do you apply these exact same principles to your own life and your own business? Because the data strongly suggests that you need to protect your personal balance sheet with the exact same rigor a central bank applies to a national economy.
The paradigm shift is to stop treating foreign exchange as a casino where you try to guess if a line on a chart is going up or down. You need to perform a rigorous exposure mapping of your life.
Like treating your life like a corporation.
Exactly. Ask yourself the foundational questions. In what currency do I earn my income? In what currency do I buy my groceries and pay my rent? Where are my investments actually domiciled? And most importantly, in what currency are my future liabilities?
Let's use a real-world example here to ground this. Imagine a family living in India, earning their entire income in rupees, but they are planning to fund their child's university education in the UK over the next 4 years.
Okay, so in strict financial terms, that family is effectively short the British pound. They have a known, massive, multi-year liability in a foreign currency. Okay. If the pound appreciates against the rupee by, say, 15% over the next 2 years, the total cost of their child's education just became 15% more expensive, completely destroying their savings calculus.
Just wiped out.
Yeah. This kind of concentrated liability requires hedging far more urgently than a diversified retirement portfolio. You aren't hedging to turn a profit. You hedge to ensure a sudden currency fluctuation doesn't wipe out a major life objective.
And for the business owners and operators listening, how does this map onto corporate risk? Because the literature generally breaks corporate currency exposure into three distinct buckets: transaction, translation, and economic.
Right, let's break those down. Transaction exposure is the immediate operational risk. You signed a contract today to pay a supplier in euros in 90 days. You have a known payable but an unknown future exchange rate.
Makes sense. What about translation?
Translation exposure is an accounting reality. If your U.S. parent company has a highly profitable subsidiary in Brazil, and the Brazilian real suddenly drops 20% against the dollar, the translated value of that subsidiary's earnings on your consolidated balance sheet plummets.
Even if the business is doing well down there.
Exactly. It can drastically impact your stock price or valuation, even if the Brazilian business is totally dominating its local market.
And economic exposure, that sounds much broader.
It's the long game. It is your strategic, structural competitiveness. Even if your entire supply chain is domestic and you only sell to local customers, you still have economic FX exposure.
Wait, really? How?
Well, if your main competitor sources their materials from a country whose currency just crashed, their input costs plummet. They can suddenly afford to underprice you and steal your market share. You are exposed to global currency shifts even if you never cross a border.
That is wild to think about. So how do sophisticated companies actually fight this? Do they just load up on complex financial derivatives and hope their treasury department guesses right?
Actually, over-relying on financial engineering is incredibly dangerous. Derivatives like forward contracts and options are secondary tools. They are expensive and require constant management. The absolute gold standard for risk mitigation is a natural hedge.
Okay, let's define that. How do you build a natural hedge?
You structure your physical business operations so that your revenues and your costs organically occur in the same currency. If you are a U.S. software company expanding into Europe, you build a European support team, you lease office space there, and you host your localized servers there.
So you're spinning euros to make euros.
Precisely. The euros you collect from your European customers directly pay for your euro-denominated expenses. You neutralize the currency risk at the operational level before it ever reaches the finance department.
And if a perfect natural hedge is impossible, the advice that really stuck out to me in the report is the necessity of extreme stress testing. Don't just model a polite 2% currency shift in your quarterly projections.
Right, that's not enough.
You have to stress test your profit margins, your pricing power, and your debt covenants, which are, you know, the strict financial agreements you make with your lenders about how much cash you need to keep on hand. You have to test all of that against a violent 10, 20, or even 30% gap move in the exchange rate.
Absolutely.
Because when a geopolitical crisis hits, currencies do not glide smoothly. They gap.
They do. And it is the ultimate test of corporate resilience. If a sudden 20% currency move bankrupts your company, you don't actually have a durable business model. You have an unhedged, highly leveraged, speculative bet on global macroeconomics.
Which brings us full circle. Exchange rates are so much more than the blinking conversion fee at the airport kiosk.
Yeah.
They are the ultimate condensed price of a nation's power. They take a country's monetary discipline, its political stability, its economic vitality, and the collective trust of the global market, and compress all of that sprawling complexity into a single, constantly moving number.
They really do. And as we've unpacked today, in a financialized, dollar-centric world, currency risk only becomes truly destructive the exact moment your cash flows and your liabilities are mismatched. That mismatch is the vulnerability that exposes you to the whims of global capital.
As we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We are undeniably entering a new era of global politics. We are witnessing shifting alliance structures, the return of massive tariffs, the strategic weaponization of financial systems, and the looming potential for capital controls.
Let's take that a step further because it raises a critical question for the future. The foreign exchange markets are no longer just pricing economic data like inflation and GDP growth. Mm. They are increasingly pricing jurisdictional trust.
Right.
So ask yourself, if your personal wealth, your career trajectory, and your business operations are tied exclusively to just one currency, how resilient is your personal balance sheet if the global market suddenly decides your specific jurisdiction is no longer trustworthy?
It fundamentally changes how you look at the world, doesn't it? The next time you are dragging your suitcase through an airport terminal and you pass by that brightly lit kiosk, take a second look at those blinking red and green numbers. You aren't just looking at the price of a coffee. You are looking at the price of power. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and keep questioning the numbers on the screen.